Congratulations. You found it.
You know what time it is.
This is New York Game Day. It's 3 hours of the most informative and entertaining NFL news in the league. Now here's former NFL defensive lineman Chris Canty, former Jets GM and ESPN insider Mike Tannenbaum, and your host, Anita Marks.
Welcome in. It is New York Game Day here on 98.7 ESPN. Week two. Man, unbelievable. And we've got 2 1 o'clock games, both the Jets and the Giants. We've got the Jets, who are taking on the San Francisco 49ers. Talk about a 1-2 punch, week one and week two. And the Giants, of course, in Chi-Town, taking on the Chicago Bears. Without further ado, Chris Canty, my man. How you doing? Good morning.
I'm doing good, Anita. I'm excited for some football today. We got week two, so you know injuries are always a concern for all of the teams. Jets got a few guys banged up, but they're in a tough position because they took a tough L up in Buffalo. They got to have a much better showing this Sunday in the Meadowlands.
That's for sure. And, of course, Mike Tannenbaum, new addition to our New York Game Day show, joins us as well. Good morning, Mike.
Yeah, it's great to be with you guys, and no soft tissue injuries for me. So unlike a lot of the people around the league, it's good to be back for week two. And, you know, I think what's really interesting to me, guys, is we're seeing such incredible injuries so early on. Like, what is it going to be like in week three and four? Again, because if we think about in a normal year, we're going into week two of the preseason. So we have so far to go and so many significant injuries. I think it's going to be such a part of the fabric of the 2020 season, literally which teams can survive as healthy as possible.
That's for sure. And listen, we're going to dive into this a little bit later on the show, but we've got, it's not just a few names, it's big names. It's players that have a lot of game, like game making, game player ability to help teams win football games, like Michael Thomas, you know, like George Kittle, like Kenny Galladay. So we're going to dive into that a little bit later on the show. But guys, let's start with the Jets. Again, unfortunately, they lose to the Bills. Another difficult matchup this week against the 49ers. But before we start breaking down that game, man, Chris, I know you host all week long with Canty and Dave. I was on yesterday. The plethora of calls coming in, guys that are just already over Sam Darnold, time to move on, he's not worth a damn, as well as just assuming that Adam Gase is gone. Let's start with you, Canty. Your thoughts on Sam Darnold. For those callers, those Jets fans who've already given up on this young man, is that fair at this stage in his career?
Well, here's the thing, Anita. I don't know what to think of Sam Darnold because I don't know whether or not Adam Gase can coach. I mean, that's the toughest part about the evaluation process with a young player like Sam. I mean, he's been in the National Football League 3 years. He's already had to learn 2 offensive systems. And this is supposed to be year 2 in Adam Gase's system, and we're supposed to see him ascend and see the trajectory toward a franchise quarterback. But based on the question marks with the head coach, I don't know how to properly evaluate Sam. What I can tell you is that the Jets weren't ready to play a football game up in Buffalo this past Sunday. They weren't. I mean, they looked incompetent. They looked inept. When you have penalties coming on a possession 10, that doesn't make any sense. And what I mean by that is possession 10. When you just receive the ball on a kick and your offense is coming out, how do you take a delay of game penalty? That's inexcusable to me. But the Jets had 100 yards of penalties and you had 2 turnovers. They're not talented enough to be able to overcome those types of mistakes. And so, again, when you have those in the first game of the season, to me it makes me look at the head coach and raise an eyebrow because there was no reason why the New York Jets came out and looked as unprepared as they did against the Bills.
Mike?
Yeah, look, some of it is indefensible. With that said, just to give a little bit more context, you know, if you go back a year ago, Coach Gase's first year with the Jets, and you look at all the injuries they had $61.5 million of salary cap space on IR. So, again, not making excuses, but, again, just to remind the audience, my first year with Coach Gase in Miami, 2016, we went to the playoffs. We had a healthy Ryan Tannehill. He won 10 games. Obviously, things have not started off nearly as well here in New York. Again, I think we go back to last year, look at the injuries overall, look at the injuries at the quarterback position. With that said, I do agree with Chris. I was expecting more last week, as you guys heard me say, for 3 hours. And maybe the thing that was most alarming from a big picture standpoint was Buffalo ran 28 more plays than the Jets, which is really – and that was the biggest difference across the league in every game. But, Chris, you know this as a former player – that's hard to do for one team to have 28 more plays than the other. So I think one of the things as a Jet fan I would have looked for today is just simply controlling the line of scrimmage. San Francisco has a dominant front. They're going to need to play better up front, really on the offensive line. You could call it Sam Darnold's development. You could call it ball control, whatever you want. But until they can maintain at least break even on the line of scrimmage on the offensive side of the ball, it skews everything else because it puts so much pressure on your defense. So the key for me is what an opportunity for the Jets on offense to tamp down all this noise by at least holding serve and playing to a tie up front against that really good 49er front.
And Mr. T, I think in order for them to do that, you've got to have a lot of short, quick passes in your aerial attack. To me, this is not a San Francisco front that you want to mess with in terms of being in 5 and 7 step drops. This is one of those where you want Sam to get the ball out of his hands as quickly as possible, early and often. It serves two purposes. First, it helps him get into a better rhythm than what we saw up in Buffalo, but I also think it keeps that 49ers pass rush at bay. I mean, I'm sitting there watching the tape of their game against the Cardinals last week, and on the second defensive snap of the game, Nick Bosa is beating DJ Humphreys like a drum. I mean, basically does an up and under move and comes in untouched, unabated, and hits Kyler Murray. Now, Kyler Murray gets the ball out of his hands quickly in that Cliff Kingsbury offense, but I just looked at that and said, that's probably not something that you want to major in terms of 5 and 7 step drops when you're talking about a rookie left tackle going up against one of the best edge rushers in the game.
You know, and that's a great point, Chris. Working with Adam for those years in Miami, he always talked about breather plays for the quarterback and long handoffs. So I totally agree. And when you look specifically today, and obviously Bell is going to be out, Crowder's out, to me, a key guy is going to be Chris Herndon, because he's a guy that could take that quick pass and make explosive plays. Because you look at this team now, I love Frank Gore. We had Frank in Miami, but better days are certainly behind him. So you say, where are these explosive chunk plays are going to come from? Again, it's going to have to be the quick game. And to me, a guy that really needs to step up is Chris Herndon. And maybe somebody else. Is it Perryman? Because Perryman could at least get down the field. But they're going to need chunk plays from somebody, and I look at Perryman and Herndon as those two possibilities.
You know, in talking to a number of scouts, and Chris, you know, Mike, I always see with the combine. Chris, you know how much I love the combine. You know, I've heard good things about Sam Darnold, and one thing specifically is his anticipation. And that's something that is Michael Lombardi, a phrase I'll steal from him, called the crib factor. It's something you're born with. It's not something that you can teach. And some of the intangibles that Sam Darnold has, I want to still believe that he does have. And I'm not giving up on Sam Darnold yet. But, you know, I think there's some really big question marks here in regard to Adam Gase and his coaching style. And is he the right fit for this organization, if they truly still believe that Sam Darnold is their guy in that development? But at the same time, and Mike, I'd love to hear you with this, and that is, not only am I receiving calls from Jets fans that have already given up on Sam Darnold, but also they're just anticipating that Adam Gase is out the door after this season. So if that's the case, let's say, hypothetically speaking, they bring in a new head coach, that head coach, as we know, they bring in their coaching staff, new offensive coordinator. This will be the third system that Sam Darnold is going to have to learn. And when you look at, you know, his contract and you know, what does the organization do with it, and then the development process, not as fast as one would like, there's just no win-win situation here. How are you seeing this play out with both Sam Darnold and Adam Gase? Mike.
Yeah, you know, Anita, there's a lot there. And really, and this may not be what fans want to hear today, but the easiest and maybe the most productive solution, based on really the factors you laid out, is to do nothing, which is the quarterback position is a developmental position. And we could look at countless number of examples of it just takes a while sometimes for quarterbacks to get to where they want to go. You know, a number of years ago, we had Chad Pennington at the Jets. He sat for 3 years, and we had Vinny Testaverde, and we could hold serve. I could tell you something. one of the things that makes me as upset as anything is what Cincinnati's doing right now. And let me say exactly why. Clearly, Joe Burrow has an incredible future. But when they put him out there and he's throwing it 60 times against that behind that offensive line, he has no chance. Zero. Zero, zero, zero to make it through a season. And you have a guy like Andy Dalton. Why in the world would you give up on Andy Dalton when you should see that as an investment in Joe Burrow's future, who you want to be great for the next 10 years? So that move makes no sense. So my point being is it takes sometimes a little bit longer than you want. We've already seen one change with Sam Darnold in terms of who he was drafted by, who he was being developed by. So if you make another change, why do we think it's just going to happen overnight? So sometimes patience isn't the thing that sells newspapers or drives talk show radio in terms of like tamping down the concerns, but it may serve the franchise best long term, just in terms of giving him a foundation to be successful with some continuity. And Daniel Jones is another example. I know, Anita, we'll get to the Giants here in a second, but you know, by having him wait a minute or two last year, that's only going to serve him well for the future.
Wow. Well, here's what I'll say about this. When you speak to the Cincinnati Bengals situation, I understand what you mean about not having the talent level to be able to support a young quarterback. It's clear that the Bengals aren't, from a talent standpoint, on par with the rest of the teams in that division. But the one thing that I will say about what I've seen in Cincinnati the last two games under Joe Burrow is that the Cincinnati Bengals are a competitive team. You're talking about both of those games being a fourth quarter game, and I don't necessarily know that that would be the case if Andy Dalton is still your quarterback, because I don't look at Andy Dalton as a guy that can elevate the play of all the guys around him. I don't see that. I see Andy Dalton as somebody that's more of a trailer and not a tractor. And what I mean by that is somebody that kind of goes along versus somebody that can pull everybody along. And Joe Burrow has shown that he has the potential to be able to do that in just this small sample size in the NFL. You worry about him getting David Carr syndrome and having the career knocked out of him, but at the same time, the best way to improve as a football player is to actually be out there in the games. And it seems, based on his poise and the demeanor that he has on the field, that this kid is more than capable of being able to handle it. He's a cool customer. So you do worry about it from an injury standpoint, but from the perspective of him being overwhelmed, I just don't see that happening.
Chris, I see what you're saying. My point, guys, is this. Like, do you think it's reasonable that he'll play 16 games healthy? And if you're the Bengals, knowing that it's going to be hard to beat Baltimore this year or Pittsburgh this year or close the gap on Cleveland, why would you put him in harm's way right from day one, game one, when he's had no preseason games? And I'd be worried about, again, from a front office standpoint, like, I don't want this guy to get hurt. And that's my point. Like, is it reasonable to think he's going to be healthy for 16 games?
Well, I think you got to play him. I mean, you can't keep him in kids' gloves. And the fact that there is no preseason game, that's actually, pushes me a little further to my point, which is getting the kid out of there and letting him get some game experience. Now, you got to teach him to protect himself. And that sack that he took against Sheldon Rankins when he's rolling out on that boot, that's a hit that he shouldn't take. Throw the football away or get down, but don't take that sack. That was a bad sack. That was on him. So certainly there are other examples from that offensive line that you would look at and say, well, no, Joe Burrow absolutely needs to be protected better. But there are also some instances where you can say, okay, this is a spot where you can teach the kid to protect himself. But that stuff will come along as you get a chance to dive into the tape and study with your coaching staff. But the one thing that I would say when you look at the contrast between where Joe Burrow is at and where Sam Darnold is at is just their overall feel for the game. Like, when I watch the Jets play on offense, it doesn't look like Sam Darnold is comfortable executing the game plan. There's no consistency. They don't get into a rhythm. And those things, to me, have to bring up the conversation when you look at him about Adam Gase and whether or not he's playing to the strengths of his quarterback and his offense.
Gentlemen, I would imagine Jets fans watching that Thursday night football game and watching Joe Burrow, even though Cincinnati did lose to Cleveland, man, he looked good. I would imagine that there are Jets fans out there going, really? Really? Comparing the two.
Now back to New York Game Day with Chris Canty, Mike Tannenbaum, and Anita Marks on 98.7 ESPN.
Can you
Mike Tannenbaum, Chris Canty. You're listening to Hour 2 of New York Game Day. Talked about the Jets and the 49ers and their game at 1 o'clock. Now we're going to flip it to some Big Blue talk. My New York Giants going up to Soldier Field in Chicago. And Mr. T, in looking at that game on Monday night, I felt like the Giants had opportunities to take control of it. Obviously, they lost by 10 points, but you can point to certain turning points in that game, and namely the interception that Daniel Jones threw at the goal line on their first drive in the third quarter, and say if something different happens in that sequence, we could be talking about potentially a different outcome. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I was really impressed by the Giants. I agree. Those two turnovers were hugely consequential. But, you know, like Chris, we've talked about this. You know good football when you see it. And, boy, there was a lot to be encouraged by. Look, I know it wasn't perfect. But, boy, for his first game as a head coach, I was really, really impressed by Joe Judge, their speed, their fundamentals. There was really a lot to like about the Giants' performance. Look, they came up short. A lot of teams are going to come up short against that good Steeler front. But I was encouraged if I was a Giant fan.
Yeah, Mr. T, I thought that the Giants defensively were a lot better than what folks expected coming into this season. I thought they flew around on that side of the ball. I thought the interior defensive line did a solid job in the run game up until late. But I thought that they did some nice things. The one thing that I would probably say I was most impressed with was the lack of penalties. The Giants only had 4 penalties for 25 yards, and they didn't aid in any of the Steelers' scoring drives with penalties. So when you start talking about trying to become a more disciplined team and trying to build a rock-solid foundation, I thought Joe Judge showed a lot of good things in his coaching debut. And one of the other things that I've got to give some love to Joe Judge for is he lets his coaches coach. I mean, you saw that Patrick Graham called the defense. You saw that Jason Garrett called the offense. And to me, when you have a leader that's willing to delegate and share responsibilities, I think that that's one of those things that lends itself to your team having success, because you don't have somebody that's trying to micromanage. When you have accountability throughout an organization and you trust folks to do their jobs, I think that that's leaning toward the kind of culture that you want to build in order to have sustained success.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You want to hire good people, let them do their job, and then hold them accountable. I think that's exactly right. And I think that's what we're going to see long term. And I think, again, if Daniel Jones, if his trajectory, look, the narrative, as we've talked about quite a bit between these two teams, the Jets and the Giants, is very, very similar, which is Daniel Jones and Sam Darnold, can we sit here and say with good confidence, like, they are the future of those respective franchises? And if Daniel Jones could just clean up a couple of those game-changing decisions, there's a lot to be encouraged by. And what the fun part to me about, like, our sport, Chris, is we just don't know who's going to step up, who could take the next step for each of these teams. And when I go back to that game the other night, you know, last year's fifth-round pick, Darius Slayton, I thought he played really well. He gave me a lot of hope for the Giants in terms of another skill player. You know, the player I was probably most concerned about was Evan Engram. And we talked about this on your show during the week. I don't know if he was put in the best chance to be successful. It's really, really hard to ask tight ends now. Some of these pass rushers are so good. I was concerned about how he looked, but boy, Darius Slayton looked like a real frontline receiver based on opening day.
Yeah, Darius Slayton looked fantastic. And going back to last year's preseason, it was clear that Daniel Jones and Slayton had a connection. And so I'm excited about what that tandem can look like in the future. I think Darius Slayton has got the makings of being a really, really good receiver in this league. So that'll be fun to watch play out. But one of the things I'm also encouraged by with Daniel Jones and the Giants moving forward is that for the first time in Daniel Jones' career, he's going to have his full complement of weapons. That means he's going to have Sterling Shepard, Golden Tate, Evan Engram, and Saquon Barkley all healthy and available on the field at the same time. And I think that's going to be big for him. Having all three of his receivers, having the tight end that we think can be a matchup problem, and then having an all-world running back, I think that's only going to bode well for Daniel Jones in terms of giving him every opportunity to continue to ascend. So, Mr. T, we're talking about the good stuff with the Giants. We got to talk about the bad. You mentioned Evan Engram, another guy that's catching a lot of heat on that offensive side of the ball is Saquon Barkley. who did not look great in his season debut. I mean, Mike Tomlin talked about how they were targeting him in their game plan defensively for the week, and it showed in terms of what happened on the field. They put Saquon in some tough spots. They had a lot of guys down in the box to try to neutralize that rushing attack, and ultimately he ends up with 6 yards rushing on 15 carries. What did you see from Saquon, and is there any cause for concern?
You know, I think this could be really tightened up with good coaching. I remember being around Coach Parcells and the great Curtis Martin, and Coach always talked to Curtis about, hey, let's make sure that we run for first downs, not touchdowns. And the wisdom of that, Chris, was really fundamental, which is let's get first downs, let's move the sticks. 3 and 4 yards gains are good. Let's prevent, you know, the tackles for losses, mm-hmm. and the big plays will come at the appropriate time. So I think that's a good sort of axiom for Barkley, which is rush for first downs, not touchdowns.
Yeah, I was in Baltimore with Dean Pease, and, you know, he spent some time in New England. And one of the things that Dean used to do is go through the scouting report with us, and he would talk about running backs, and he would say, this guy understands the value of a 3 or 4 yard run. And with Saquon Barkley, you just want him to understand the value of a 3 or 4 yard run. Sometimes you can't hit the home run, but you got to make sure that you avoid the negative play. Because a run play, you know, there's a lot of value in a run play, even if you don't get the yards. If you get 2 or 3 yards, it's not necessarily a negative play, just because the attempts are going to create opportunities for your offense to be able to not only necessarily pop a big run, but set up something in play action pass, a shot down the field, an explosive play. So you just like Saquon to be a part of the offense trying to stay on schedule. And when you have a quarterback in his second year, that's one of the most valuable things a running back can do. Another thing that's important for a running back to be able to do is pass protect. And this came up last year a little bit. You saw it in that Jets game last year where Jamal Adams runs over Saquon Barkley, takes the ball out of Daniel Jones's hands, runs it in for a touchdown. It came up again on Monday night. Bud Dupree does an up and under. Saquon fails to track him in pass protection and gets his quarterback hit. At what point do you get frustrated with Saquon Barkley if you're a head coach when you see that he's allowing your quarterback to get hit in pass protection?
Yeah, I think that's all technique, Chris, because I would never question Saquon Barkley's toughness. He's been too good of a player, too explosive. At Penn State, you can't play at the level he's played at and not be tough. I mean, this is a tough man sport, and he's I have no concern about that. Now, technique-wise, absolutely, that has to get a million times better. But those things can be and should be cleaned up, and he has to be on the field for them all 3 downs because he's just too good and too valuable. So I saw that differently, and knowing his character and his work ethic, I'd be surprised that if in a couple of weeks, Chris, we weren't sitting here and it really should be a non-issue.
Well, Mr. T, and I hear what you're saying, but when we talk about technique things, is it fair to expect a running back to have pass pro technique down in year 3? Because this guy was the 2nd overall pick. He's in his 3rd year. Like, at some point, you got to be a reliable pass protector, and I'm not questioning Saquon Barkley's toughness either, but I am questioning whether or not or why he's unwilling to be a more effective pass blocker. Because we've seen him run guys over one-on-one with the ball in his hand in the open field, but I've also seen him get run over in pass protection. I can't explain why that is.
Yeah, and that's fair. And I would challenge Saquon, and you know, Coach Belichick would take his best players and challenge them in front of the team. I would assume that Joe Judge, coming from that tree, is probably pretty similar. And we'll see how it goes. But if he wants to be on the field as much as he does and as much as they need him to, that needs to. And again, I expect we'll get better.
All right, let's go to Eddie and Rockley. Eddie, you're on New York Game Day.
Hey, guys, how you doing? Yeah, I want to touch on that. You know, Chris, you know the Giants, and also that they always had a two-back system. They had the outside guy and they had the hammer. And they don't have the hammer with Barkley. And if I had to give Barkley 25 touches, the least amount I would give him is up the middle. You can pitch it to the right. You can pitch it to the left. You can off tackle. You can screen him. You can get him in the passing game. You can do a lot of things. But even in that game against Pittsburgh, there was no adjustment. Even that Pittsburgh was getting penetration, they didn't make any adjustment. And that's what I got. You got such a great athlete. and you really, really don't know what to do with them.
Well, here's the thing. I will say this. Saquon has got to get his touches, right? You know, you just have to get him involved. He needs to touch the ball 20 to 25 times a game. I think that has to be a part of the game plan. It's just a matter of how you plan on utilizing him. And to me, when you looked at the matchup against the Steelers, Saquon Barkley running the ball into the teeth of that defense is not something that made a whole lot of sense. I didn't think the Giants should major in that. I saw them use the crack toss on the first series, and they gained 7 yards of it, end up being the long runner today. I thought they should have utilized more perimeter runs, forced that front seven to move laterally as opposed to north and south and getting all that penetration in the backfield. Like, you just recognize that that wasn't a matchup that you like, the Giants' offensive line, who hasn't had a chance to be able to be in game situations together going up against that Steelers front seven.
And just to add to that, Chris, you know, we got to keep in mind, like, this is the first game they've ever played together. You know, Jason Garrett, the play caller, Daniel Jones, the quarterback, obviously trying to feature Saquon Barkley, players in and out with injuries, you know, players opting out for the season. So I just give everyone there the benefit of the doubt. And Pittsburgh has a really good front seven. And look, I can see why you want to toss the ball, but now you're tossing it to athletic guys like T.J. Watt and Bud Dupree. So, I don't know. That's I can see what philosophically why you want to get the ball to the perimeter for Saquon Barkley, but those are two really good, sturdy outside linebackers. So, I thought that was just a tough matchup. And, again, I think we're going to see a Giant offense improve, especially like if Slayton can take the next step up and make plays on the perimeter. That's going to open up things, not only in the running game, but hopefully for Evan Engram in the passing game as well.
Mr. T, we got one of your former guys on hold. We got Bart Scott. He wants to chime in on the conversation. What up, Bart?
What up, what up? I'm just listening to Uncle TB, and I just wanted to remind him of a couple of things and remind you of a couple of things, Chris. What up, Uncle TB? What up, Chris? You know, excellent show.
Good morning.
I'm entertaining myself as I go to SNY. You know, do my thug dizzle a little later. But listen, one of the biggest misconceptions in sports is that everybody that plays a physical sport is a physical guy or a tough guy. And this game will expose you. And I feel like Saquon Barkley may not have to have his heart tested in Penn State because he was always the best athlete. He was the biggest guy. He didn't have a healthy fear. But we all know that we're at the top of the triangle. And, you know, what I used to say all the time, what's a goon to a goblin? And I think that was a bit of a business decision, understanding that Bud Dupree is different from Jamal Adams running in, same size, same build, opposed to a guy like Bud Dupree coming in, and it's a healthy fear because physically he's dominated. If you blink, if you hesitate 1 second in this game, then you lose. And what caused that hesitation sometimes is fear. And we used to have this thing when we talked about Reggie Bush all the time, right? Yeah, he wants to get to the perimeter, but what happens when the defense takes that away and forces him to be a big boy? Now, I want to remind you guys of two guys that I know that had all the physical skills, had all the success, but was weak sauce, soft in the heart, and they got exposed. One was Sean Alexander, MVP, tough as nails when he had Steve Hutchinson, when he had Walter Jones. When those guys started to leave, the telegram went around the league that Sean Alexander at 230 was soft, had no heart, and we started scraping him up. And when that was exposed, he left the league shortly after and had to go to Washington after being an MVP on the cover of Madden 2 years before. Another teammate of mine, and yes, I'm naming names, one of the best athletes I ever been around, 6'2", 6'3", I don't know the specifics, but he was about 220, and he was soft as Charmin. And it was one of your draft picks, Coach. TB, Kerry Rhodes. When we saw him get ran over by Wes Walker, when Wes Walker cut back and looked him up, we knew that he could no longer play with us on that defense because you are what you put on film. And Saquon Barkley is putting weak sauce on film. And until he proves us wrong, he has to wear that scarlet letter as Mr. Sauce. Mr. Charmer. He has to wear it.
Wow. Wow. Bart Scott calling him out. Wow,
we know
Bart.
How it is. We know how it is. It's different because remember we used to think Tebow was super tough? Oh, man, yep. When he's running these quarterback draws, he's running people over, moved his ass to H-back, he didn't want that smoke. just different when you're running up and you're trying to get something and you want to run behind your pads. But when it's not a glamorous position when you got to pick up a blitz or you got to do something, that's different. That's when your real heart is put in display on display for everybody to see. We thought Tebow was tough. Hey. Oh, look how he run people over.
Bart, I want to – Bart, Anita Marks here. How you doing, my friend?
Oh, what up? What'd it do? My bad. I just called. I thought it was just a boy. No.
It's good. No. Because I want to share this story. And Chris has heard this story before. I don't know if Mike has. But I met Bart when Bart was on special teams in Baltimore, and he was competing to be a linebacker. And Willis McGahee was the running back. And this is when Harbaugh had just taken over the team from Brian Billick. And they were doing live two-a-days. None of this, oh, don't touch me. I only want to practice 2 hours a day BS that we're seeing right now. So we're there. Bart's competing for a spot. It's live practice. Bart comes in, hits Willis McGahee. All of a sudden, I look down, and I've got Willis's tooth on my shoe. Okay? I walked over to Chad Steele, and I said, Chad, I think you might want to take this back. I think this is Willis McGahee's tooth. You know, it's that type of physicality, Bart, that we don't see anymore, and it's just not Saquon Barkley, right? I think it's I don't want to use the word majority, but it's a lot. The physicality has left the game, even to the point that, you know, that I had experienced with you when we were in Baltimore. Agree or disagree? Yeah.
No, absolutely. And what happens is you get exposed because, listen, anybody can do the easy work. But do you do the easy, do you do the hard work? We always talk about jumping on the grenade for our guy, right? For the majority of my career, I was Ray Lewis's fullback, right? And do you do that type of work when it's your turn to do it with as much vigor and joy and selflessness as when other people are asked to do it for you? And I don't see that. Some guys are front runners. It's all good when everybody else is sticking on them double teams and coming downhill and, you know, cutting people. And we ask receivers to come in the box and, you know, crack back on the defensive end for Saquon to get to the edge. But when it's time for him to stick his nose in there and shorten the distance, listen, one of the toughest guys I've ever met, but he looks like Babyface, but he will hit you underneath the chin, is Bilal Powell. Don't look the part. But, man, does he play the part. You know, so, like, eventually people will see. You can fool people every once in a while. And we talked about Saquon being able to get the dirty yard. He's in the same system that Ezekiel Elliott was in. Why not get the production? I understand he doesn't have the same offensive line. But sometimes we just want to see our running back on a power with a pull-down block, the ultimate test of who got machismo. Mano a mano in the hole. Anybody that played against me, and whether it was a guard, a tackle, a fullback, understood I was an equal opportunity ass kicker. I didn't care who it was. Can man. Anybody can get some. And you win some, you lose some. But guess what? You got to be willing to take it longer than the next man. And to do that, you have to show your heart. Because you ain't going to always win them. You got to be willing to step in the phone book and take some L's to get some W's. And I don't know if Saquon is willing to take some L's.
Yeah, Bart, Bill Parcells used to always call it stick your face in the fan. And that's one of the things that you want to see Saquon Barkley do when he doesn't have the ball in his hands. And I think it's fair to question that. Nobody's questioning his toughness as a player, but I think we can question why he's not a better pass protector in year three, knowing that you used the second overall pick.
And I know y'all probably –
I think that's a fair question.
I know y'all probably got a break, but same instance when you talk about heart. Last week we saw two running backs have to take an L, right? Saquon chose not to take the L with Bud Dupree. Bud Dupree is physically imposing. Is he more imposing than Aaron Donald? Nope. But did we see – Ezekiel Elliott flinch? No. He knew he was going to take that L. But he willingly took that L because that's his job. And he don't care what people say about him on film. All he knows is Dak was upright. And he did not flinch. You win some, you lose some. Take it on the chin, get your ass up, and get some more. Be willing to take it longer than the next man. That's what this game is all about. When you play physical sports, it's a test of will. It's going to hurt both people. Who's willing to hurt longer? I'll hurt myself to hurt you. And to him, he got to have a reality check and nut up.
So this is a great infomercial of one of the best signings ever had as a GM. And I think what it comes back to, Bart, is culture. And when we signed Bart, he enhanced and brought our culture of toughness even further. And it sounds crazy, but, you know, here's this huge free agent signing. And one of the more consequential plays that Bart made was forcing a fumble in a preseason game against Brandon Jacobs. And when I think everyone saw him do that in a preseason game, it showed, hey, this is what we stand for. This is the standard. And what I would say is, being around Coach Belichick a couple times in my career, knowing that Joe Judge doesn't fall far from that tree, guys, I would expect that Joe Judge showed those plays in front of the whole team this week. And knowing that Saquon Barkley wants to be a great player, we'll see. That's what coaching is all about. Is it going to get better? But I promise you, if Joe Judge is anywhere close to what Bill Belichick was, he will determine Saquon Barkley's play time based on his ability to become a more consistent pass protector. Because if he's not, he's not going to have him on the field on third down. That's not going to sit well with Barkley. It's that old expression, guys. Fear does the work of reason. And to me, this is a great opportunity for Joe Judge to say, this is the standard for my team.
Now back to New York Game Day with Chris Canty, Mike Tannenbaum, and Anita Marks on 98.7 ESPN.
New York Game Day here on 98.7 ESPN. Chris Canty, Mike Tannenbaum, and Anita. It's time to break down some of the top storylines heading into week two. And guys, probably the biggest is, and we touched on it a little bit when we opened up the show, and that's soft tissue injuries. Wide receiver Michael Thomas from the Saints out, not just this week, but for several weeks, apparently with a high ankle sprain. And, you know, we know that sometimes that's even worse than a break. George Kittle not getting the go today against the Jets. Kenny Golladay, who had a phenomenal year last year, he's going to be out. They're going to be starting a rookie at wide receiver, and Chris Godwin out for the Tampa Bay Bucks. So so Mike, let's start with you. Out of the big name players that are going to be inactive today, which is the player in the team that you think is going to be affected the most?
Well, I think Kittle is interesting because, boy, maybe this is just a continuation of old school football here with Bart and Chris. But one of the things that Kittle does a great job of is he's really like a third tackle. He does a great job of capturing the edge. So on San Francisco's perimeter run game, he does such a great job of capturing the edge, and he allows the running backs to make great plays in space. So it may not show up directly in the stat sheet, Anita, but George Kittle, to me, is a massive concern for San Francisco, not just in receiving, but as importantly in their run game.
Yeah, for me, Chris? it's Michael Thomas. I mean, the Saints' offense didn't look great in their regular season debut. And you know, to me, the last couple of years, you've seen some signs of slippage from Drew Brees. Not having Michael Thomas, I mean, a guy that got a ton of targets last year. It always gets a ton of targets year in, year out. To me, that's going to be huge in terms of what that offense is going to look like and who Drew's go-to guys are going to be. Like, Michael Thomas is clearly Drew Brees' go-to guy. And not having him available on Monday night on the road in Las Vegas, I think that's an interesting game to watch.
For me, guys, it's Kenny Golladay. You've got a secondary that's banged up. Coleman on IR. Trufant is expected to be inactive today. Okuda is dealing with a hamstring issue. Going up against Aaron Rodgers at Lambeau Field. Matthew Stafford's going to be playing catch-up. And to not have Golladay on the field, I think is going to hurt them big time. Some other news this week. Mike, explain this to me, please. How are the Jets – where are they getting – they have a money tree out there in Los Angeles? I mean, I feel like each and every week they're paying – they're able to pay their big-name players. What are they doing financially in order to really make happy all their top players?
Yeah, Anita, this is a great topic, and we could go into this for a really long time because you have the same questions I do and a lot of people around the league, especially when you exacerbate what you just said by they're going to go five consecutive years without a first-round pick. And really what you're going to see quickly with the Rams is going to be the haves and the have-nots, where more of the money is going to less of the players. So when you think about guys like Kupp, Woods, Donald, Ramsey, Goff, draw a line, and it's going to be everybody else. And they've already lost like good football players players like Greg Zuerlein and Clay Matthews and Corey Littleton, and it's going to hurt from a team-building standpoint. Their middle class, it also is going to eviscerate their depth. So I think when you take five consecutive first-round picks and put that between Goff and Ramsey, who, again, they're great. I would say Ramsey's a great player. I couldn't call Jared Goff a great player. Mm. But I just think from a sustainability standpoint, a lot of people are questioning whether or not this can work. And we'll see. I think they're probably the third or fourth best team in that division. And I think how they're building the team is a very risky way to go.
And I wanted to ask you about that, Mr. T, because eventually that bill comes due when you're paying all your top guys and you're not building quality depth and you don't have a way to add top-end talent with high draft picks. I mean, at what point do we see Les Snead, their general manager, decide to strip this team down and rebuild? Because it feels like they've pushed all the chips to the middle of the table for a 2 or 3 year window, and we're on the precipice of that window closing.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. And again, I think we saw that they already lost some good players, you know, just from a standpoint of that middle class that we've talked about. And again, Robert Woods, I love Cooper Kupp. I just don't know if you have to keep all these players. And again, when you make a mistake of trading, giving up multiple first-round picks for Jalen Ramsey and not doing an extension then, I think that at least caused them a minimum of $40 million in cap space.
Now, Mr. T, you said that the Rams are probably the third or fourth team in that division. I think you're probably putting the 49ers and the Seahawks as 1-2 in no particular order.
That's exactly right. And I think Arizona, look, they went in and they beat a good 49er team in San Francisco. So I think it's certainly Seattle, San Francisco, draw a line. And then Arizona's closing the gap with the Rams, in my opinion.
And that was the team I wanted to ask you about. You were leading me into my next question. That's why you're the best in the business. But with that Arizona Cardinals team, I mean, I guess everybody last year looked at this as an experiment with Cliff Kingsbury and Kyler Murray. I mean, the Cardinals gave up on Josh Rosen in a year and ended up shifting gears with the number one overall pick and took Kyler Murray. And people really didn't know how that experiment was going to work. But after watching them upset the 49ers in week one, I mean, what are your prospects for what this Cardinals team could potentially be this season?
Yeah, we saw what happened last week with DeAndre Hopkins. They're going to be explosive. Look, I drafted Kenyon Drake. I know how good he is. They're going to score points. And they may have the best pass rusher in the NFL in Chandler Jones. And because he plays in Arizona, we don't get a chance to speak about him enough. But I love their defensive coordinator, a gentleman named Vance Joseph, who I was with in Miami. So I think there's a lot of interesting pieces there. Now it's just going to be a question of can Kyler Murray take the next step? Can he stay healthy? And defensively, you know, do they have enough to slow teams down? And they did last week. I don't think Garoppolo played very well. So they're an interesting team to me, and I really have a lot of concerns about the Rams.
Yeah, a lot of concerns about the Rams. I'm sure a lot of people in Minnesota have concerns about their Vikings after watching what happened in the show that Aaron Rodgers put on in Minneapolis. What is your gauge on this team? I know you talked about their offensive line not being what it was from a year ago and some pieces being, you know, missing. You know, they don't have Danielle Hunter right now. You know, he's unavailable to him. Like, what's your gauge on what's going on with this Minnesota team? Because, listen, when you're talking about them going on the road playing against an Indianapolis team that's trying to find a way to get a win because they lost last week to the Jaguars, I mean, you could be talking about the Vikings staring 0-2 in the face, and I know that's not where Mike Zimmer wants to be. So what's your feeling on what kind of Vikings team we're going to see this Sunday?
Yeah, I think one of the things we didn't talk enough about last week, and I fault myself, is it's always going to be about a game of matchups. And we talked so much in the offseason about, you know, Green Bay not getting weapons for Aaron Rodgers, and that is true. And we'll see, you know, if Valdes-Scantling and some of these other younger receivers can continue to develop for Green Bay to go opposite Davante Adams. But here's the reality. Minnesota lost three corners. And it looked that way. It looked like 7-on-7 out there. And for our fans, 7-on-7 is a passing period where it's really designed to give the looks for the offense, really just taking the lines out of the way. And when you're doing that at practice, you're on offense, you're supposed to look good because there's no pass rush. And it kind of looked that way watching that game, that Minnesota could not cover any of the Green Bay receivers. And look, you're dealing with an all-time great in Aaron Rodgers, but that is a concern. You know, Danielle Hunter and obviously Yannick Ngakoue, when healthy, that should make a difference, you know, in terms of the pass rush. But if I'm a Viking concern, to lose your top three corners in 1 year is a lot.
Yeah, that's got to be a lot. And I know Mike Zimmer wants to play good defense. He was my defensive coordinator down in Dallas, and he always believed in making sure that the back end was shored up. Now, getting pass rush certainly helps a lot. And like we mentioned before, with no Danny Hunter, it's going to be a lot tougher for Minnesota to be able to get that done. On the flip side of that game, the Green Bay Packers look really, really good. I think that surprised some people. Are they as good as that 43-point outburst that they had in week one?
Yeah, I don't know. That really surprised me that they were able to score so many points. So, you know, we'll see. I would proceed with caution on that one, Chris. I need to see it for a couple more weeks before I'm going to anoint them as the best offense in football.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. I just don't trust the Green Bay Packers. Last year, they were a 13-win team, and they didn't really feel like a 13-win team, and we saw that in the NFC Championship game. I just feel like their general manager is taking a long-range view, and I don't think this is necessarily a championship or bust type of situation. That's just my gut feeling. I guess when you take a quarterback in the first round and you got Aaron Rodgers as your quarterback, you're not taking a win now approach. But yeah, that Green Bay team, I'm not sure if they're as good as what they showed last week. Now they're going up against the Lions, the team that you picked to win the NFC North last week. So I guess we'll see what to make of both of those teams. But with no preseason games, Mr. T, to me it's so hard to gauge exactly who these teams are. You know, if you have an opportunity to see the starters in a couple of preseason games and then week one, you have a much better feel of who these teams are. But in looking back at week one, who's a team that you feel pretty good about in terms of being a title contender that nobody's talking about right now?
The New England Patriots. Because we know they have a great secondary. We know they have, obviously, a great coach in Coach Belichick. And again, I think what's so fascinating is, what does it look like after tonight in terms of, if I'm Pete Carroll, we know what, hey, let's go into that meeting room. We know what they're saying all week long, which is Cam Newton's not going to beat us. This running game is not going to beat us. So he's going to have to beat us with his arm. And if they play well tonight, I think New England's going to be sort of like a little bit under the radar, if that's possible, given all their success for, you know, over the last countless number of years. But I just think this team's going to look different. I think they're going to have a big chip on their shoulder in terms of things that they want to prove to others. And again, I think it's all set up for Cam Newton. So I'm fascinated about by tonight's game.
Yeah, I can't wait for that game tonight. I think it's this clash of the Titans. I am all here for it. When we get back, we're going to dive a little deeper into the Giants matchup with the Chicago Bears. You're listening to Mike Tannenbaum, Anita Marks, and Chris Canty on New York Game Day, 98.7 ESPN.
Now back to New York Game Day with Chris Canty, Mike Tannenbaum, and Anita Marks on 98.7 ESPN.
Don't believe me, just watch.
Now back to New York Game Day with Chris Canty, Mike Tannenbaum, and Anita Marks on 98.7 ESPN.
Welcome back. New York Game Day, Hour 3. And we kick it off with a special guest, and that's Jordan Renan, who covers the Giants for ESPN. Welcome in, Jordan. Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate you, my friend.
Good morning, everyone. Another big week of football. We made it to week 2. This is accomplishment. There's no positive COVID test throughout the league, which is pretty remarkable.
It is. It absolutely is. All right. Let's first touch base and tee up for you Saquon Barkley. A lot of comments from Tiki Barber, a number of people, 15 carries, held to 6 yards, no bueno. Also, Tiki criticizing him in regard to lack of pass protection. What has been this week of practice for him? Where is he mentally as they head to Chicago to take on a very good Bears rushing defense?
Yeah, look, this is kind of the first time in Saquon Barkley's career that people are really taking him into task in regards to his play, right? I mean, he's been the golden child, the gold jacket guy, Dave Gettleman's, future Hall of Famer. But this is really, the point where he's actually heard it more and from multiple angles. And he knew early in his press conference the other day, or virtual Zoom press conference, he's like, look, I know you guys, this is going to be the topic. This is the question you're asking. And he sort of like gave a statement, look, I don't care. I only care about the people in the locker room, of what they think. And it was like a sort of like a preemptive strike, but nevertheless, he got asked about it, throughout the whole thing. But it just goes to show you, this is something he keeps hearing from different angles, and whether he wants to think it is or not, it's going to be a motivating factor. He wants to now prove everybody wrong. So I think that's kind of where you're at with Saquon Barkley this week. The Giants coaches, they coached him hard. They're not going to lie to him. That the film spoke for itself. Because let's be honest, Latiki said, in a large degree, he was not wrong. Like, the blocking was bad. And if he's not going to be better at the blocking aspect of it, I wouldn't even be surprised to see a little bit today. When they're in third and long and they're really not going to run the ball and you just need their running back to block, you might see Deion Lewis sneak in there for some of those snaps. I mean, that's the reality. So that's where you stand with Saquon Barkley. But Adrian Peterson, the corpse of Adrian Peterson, 14 rushes, 93 yards against this Bears defense last week. This is not the Pittsburgh Steelers that Saquon's facing on Sunday.
Jordan, I know you tweeted about it last night, but this is going to be potentially the first time Daniel Jones has his full complement of weapons, with Golden Tate being poised to come back from injury. Where are we with Golden Tate? Is he going to be on any sort of a pitch count? What can Giants fans expect to see from him today?
I think you could expect to see – look, here's the reality, is they have Sterling Shepard and they have Darius Slayton. They're going to play a ton of two and three tight end sets anyway. That's what this offense is going to be. That's what it was going to be from day one. And Golden Tate was probably going to be sort of like working that little rotation, but if anything, he was probably going to be kind of the number three guy anyway. So you'll probably see him, but you're not going to see him on the field for 80% of the snaps. That was never going to be the case anyway. Where I do think you might see him a little bit is in the punt return game. That was sort of the plan from day one, although Jabril Peppers was really good at it in the opener. But, that's sort of his role. Be a playmaker on special teams, be mixed in there as the third receiver. Let's say they play 11 personnel, 40% of the snaps. Like that's sort of going to be his role, especially early coming back from this hamstring injury. Now, he could have probably played. Like if last week was a playoff game, I think he would have played. So they were just being cautious with him. So I don't think this should be a problem where he's going to come back and you're going to see a guy who's clearly, not 100%. Like he should be pretty good to go. But his role is going to be a little bit pulled back from what it was in previous years.
Hey, Jordan, just turning to the other side of the ball here. How do you think the Giants match up with the Bear offense? And in particular, I thought up front Leonard Williams was pretty active last week. And how do you think the offensive line of Chicago matches up with the front of the Giants?
Yeah, well, what works in the Giants' favor in this one is that the Giants are going to be good up front, especially with that, it's stopping the run. The Bears are a team, they want to control sort of the game through their run, right? They don't want to go and throw Mitchell Trubisky back there for 40 passes in the game. That is not their recipe to success. Now, that the Giants with, Dexter Lawrence and Dalvin Tomlinson and Leonard Williams, you're right, who played very well the other day, that's the strength of this defense, is being able to stop the run. Now, if anything, it's the Tariq Cohens of the world that have in the past given this Giants defense trouble by attacking those edges. But if you say one thing about the cornerbacks last week, maybe, in coverage, definitely questionable, but Corey Ballantyne and James Bradbury both did very well against the run of protecting those edges and playing physical on those edges. I mean, Corey Ballantyne, I think, was second on the team in tackles. And a lot of that was against the run on the edges. So I think the Giants do match up pretty well with this Bears team. Now, here's the one place that they don't match up very well, is guarding Allen Robinson. Because you look at Juju Smith-Schuster last week, what did they do with Juju and the Steelers? They put him in that slot, right? They get him away from James Bradbury, who's the Giants' best cornerback. I think that's pretty clear right now. And they move him around the field and out of the slot, where Juju, I think he took like 85% of his snaps from the slot. Six targets, six catches, 96 yards and 2 touchdowns. So, Allen Robinson, what did the Bears do against the Giants last year when they played? They said they put Allen Robinson in the slot. Granted, Corey Ballantyne was there at the time, completely out of position where he was playing in the slot last year. But they put Allen Robinson in the slot, and they had a drive. Basically, they went down the entire field. They threw to Allen Robinson almost every single play. I think he had like 4 or 5 catches on the drive alone, and that's where they did their damage. So that's what the Giants are going to have to try and figure out. How are they going to guard Allen Robinson when they move around the field and move him into the slot? Because Allen Robinson is the Bears' best receiver. That's pretty clear cut. And that is the Giants' weakness of guarding that slot and guarding guys on the inside.
Jordan, switching over to the other side of the ball, another area of concern has to be the Giants' offensive line and how they're going to hold up on the edges going up against not only Khalil Mack, but what looks like a healthy Robert Quinn. He's expected back from an ankle injury. Do we have any word from the Giants on what they're planning to do in order to try to help out those tackles on the edges?
Yeah. I mean, the 2-3 tight ends, Chris. I mean, you're going to see that again this week. Fully going to see the fullback on the field a lot more than you did last week. Now, this is the thing with the pass blocking. It's not just the offensive line, right? Because those tight ends and those running backs, they have to do a better job than they did last week. I mean, they were asking Saquon to chip on guys. They were asking, you know, the tight ends to help out. But if they're not going to be successful, look, the Giants have a rookie left tackle. He was okay in his debut. I went back and watched it. There was some good and there was some bad from it. And then they have Cam Fleming on the other side. He's a guy who's, for the most part of his career, he's been a swing tackle. So neither of those guys are going to be, you say, okay, go play 60 snaps against Khalil Mack. Go play 60 snaps against Robert Quinn. If that's the case, Daniel Jones might as well just throw up his hands. Saquon Barkley has no chance. They're going to get crushed. Those tight ends and those running backs have to help out, and they're asking them to do it last week. They just didn't do a good enough job. And they have to do a better job on Sunday. Otherwise, the Giants, we're going to be talking about the same thing again. The offensive line's not good enough. Their blocking's not good. Saquon's getting crushed. And Daniel Jones is under consistent pressure. And it's too much to win football games.
Jordan Renan joining us here on 98.7 ESPN New York Game Day. Jordan, there's a lot of shark money out in Vegas on the Giants getting 5.5. There are some people on the money line. It is a lot of points, but there's also some people on the money. A lot of people think, and maybe it's because Trubisky is still the starting quarterback. It's not Nick Foles. If you did watch that game, Chicago won, but a lot of people feel they should have lost. Give us like your top two keys to the game. Well, first of all, do you think the Giants have a shot? I know any given Sunday, of course, to beat the Bears. And if they do, give me your two key points as to how that's going to happen.
Yeah, I don't see there being a huge – like, the Giants are – look, they've been a bad team for the last 3 years, and I've been very critical of them. The worst team in the league record-wise for the last 3 years, right? But I do really think they're a better team this year than they have been the past few years. And I think we saw that. I mean, if you think about how they were competing the other night, they had a chance to take the lead against the Steelers late in the third quarter. And then it kind of, you know, they threw that interception and it kind of fell apart. So I don't really think there's a huge gap between this team. I'm kind of surprised at the 5.5. But you tell me, Anita, because I was thinking about this recently. What is realistic? What do you give, like, you know, the home team usually gets the 3 points, right, for being at home. Is it still worth 3 points these days?
It's a great question.
There is the no fans.
Right. It is a great question. Keep in mind, teams are able to pipe in noise sounds. You know, teams that have, you know, unbelievable decibel levels like Seattle and Kansas City lose out because, from what I understand, like, you have a certain decibel that you are allowed to go to and not. But here's my question, and I'd love for you to ask the players this. How is travel different this year? Right? Because we all know, you know, guys, they travel. They like to go to other cities. It's an opportunity for them to escape, get away. They meet up with people. They're able to leave their hotel rooms. They're treated like prisoners. They can't leave their they can't even hang out in their lobby. They're subject to staying in their rooms.
I talked to guys, you know, last night and this morning about, you know, how the travel was, and they told me it wasn't a big deal, that there was no real issues.
Okay.
And, you know, and just from the travel part of it, the reality these days, it's not like guys are going out. You know, you go out, you maybe get something to eat, you get into like an early afternoon, you maybe like go to like an early dinner, but you have to be back for meetings by Saturday night anyway. So I don't think it's a huge difference. They're stuck in the hotel room for half a day, you know, and then they kind of do meetings, and then game day, kind of same thing. No, nobody's really going out on game day morning anymore, like especially for a 1 o'clock game on the road. Those days are pretty much over. Everything is so controlled with the schedule. So I'm not sure it's that big a deal. I mean, they don't get to go out to, you know, an early dinner with like friends or family when they're in town or whatever that may be. But I mean, it's just basically a business trip. You go in, it's all football, and you come home the next day. I mean, that's pretty much what it is, right? A 24-36 hour business trip.
You know, just to add on to what Jordan was saying, just talking to people both in the NBA bubble in Orlando and over the last week in the NFL, you really hear the same thing, which is it's weird, it's different. Like, for example, one of the great things about being with a team is those Saturday nights, you have team meeting, then you have a snack, and a lot of guys and coaches and staff, they're just hanging out together in those meeting rooms. And now it's grab and go. You can't congregate and have multiple people. So really what you're hearing is, and if you watch it carefully on the sidelines, the players are getting lost in the competition, meaning that everything is weird, it's different. But once the games start, being the bubble in the NBA in Orlando, or certainly what we saw a week ago, we saw really good football. And league-wide, we didn't see a ton of penalties or turnovers, which candidly I expected to see more of. And I think it speaks to the players and coaches and the caliber of their competitiveness. And that's what you hear from a lot of people, is that everything is weird. Pre-game, no fans. It's just different.
Yeah.
But once the game is going, you get lost in the competition.
And that piped-in crowd noise that, you know, you were talking about, I mean, I was talking to guys, they don't even hear it. I mean, it's a complete non-factor for them. Darius Slayton said he scored a touchdown. It was weird because he basically he thought he was just complete silence. Like, that's what he heard. He's celebrating. He sees his teammates running towards him. But, like, it was just complete silence. And they could tune out that stuff. But let me just say this before I go, Nina. This is a huge game for the Giants, because you guys think about it, right? They're playing a Bears team that, quite frankly, I don't know what any of you guys think of the Bears, but I don't think any of you think they're real serious contenders. They're a pedestrian team, probably stuck in the middle of nowhere. And the Giants' next three games are the Niners, at L.A. against the Rams, and then at the Cowboys. So,
brutal.
You know, if they don't get the first win here, where is the next win? And let's say they do beat one of those next three teams. The reality is they're probably going to be stuck at 1-4, because that's a tough schedule. I mean, regardless of what you probably think of those teams, none of those are easy games. So this is a big one. This is probably the most winnable of the Giants' first five games.
Jordan, really quick before we let you go, Adam Schefter's reporting that George Kittle will return week three against the Giants. Do you know if San Francisco, are they going to be seen in town? Because, again, they're obviously they're here for the Jets. They're here next week for the Giants.
Not allowed.
You might not have an answer to this. They're not allowed.
Interesting. I think what they agreed to do was they agreed to maybe go to the Greenbrier place in West Virginia for the week.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's what the agreement was. But there was definitely something where they didn't want them staying, because look, where are they going to go practice? Where, you know, then where's a facility that they're going to go that gets clearance with all the COVID restrictions? There's a lot of things to it. But Anita, I saw I was just watching ESPN a while ago. The West Coast team coming over to the East Coast for the early games, 11-4-1 against the spread in the last 15. So I don't know. The travel these days, with the way that they're able to travel and the way it's just the ease of it, it doesn't seem to be as big a factor as it probably used to be.
Jordan, thank you so much for spending some time with us this morning. Really do appreciate you and your insight. Enjoy the game.
You got it. Have a great show, everybody.
Now back to New York Game Day with Chris Canty, Mike Tannenbaum, and Anita Marks on 98.7 ESPN.